So, warm welcome, everybody. I'm Daniel Four, and I'm here with Josh Schrey. And it's the equinox, happy equinox. It's autumn equinox here in the northern half of our good earth. And this free teaching guided ritual, 90-minute time, we're calling Earth as lover, healer, and kin, I think. But we're going to talk about whatever we want to. But it'll be a little bit connected to that. And I'm glad for you to trust us enough to spend your time in this way. And I'd like to open with a prayer. So if you would, do whatever helps you to really gather yourself and gift yourself with the time, whether you're here live or listening in later to the recording. And yeah, we'll make good use of it. Give acknowledgement and praise to the holy mystery within me and within all others. I give acknowledgement and thanks to my ancestors of blood and to the other powers that support me in my life and my family here. Give acknowledgement and thanks and praise to the ancestors who speak through this land in La Zubia, Granada, Andalusia, and el sur de España. I give acknowledgement and thanks to Josh and his people and the ones that support him and to all those gathered here and those listening in later. May the collective field of support and goodwill and kindness hold a generous, connective container so that whatever is really useful can come through. Help me and Josh to be capable and humble and connective guides for the time. And may this contribute in a modest way to good vibes on the earth right now when there's so much suffering and turmoil and change and strain on the systems. So may we enjoy the time. Thanks. It's good to be alive and good to be acknowledging the cycles that we continue to move through. Ashe. So, hey, let me say a thing about the intent for our time. As I understand it here, our intent is to explore some ways that we directly personally experience the sentience, the being, the deity that is this earth. And to do that in a way that's open-ended, curious, inviting. So we're working from an animist relational ethic and wondering what is it to live out and actually lean into year after year, relational earth-honoring values. So we'll talk about that in a kind of grounded, connected way, hopefully. We'll follow the flow of me saying a few opening things here for 5, 10 minutes. Then we'll each teach for around maybe 10 minutes and then chat with one another and then guide a practice for maybe 15 minutes and then spend some time in dialogue, Q&A, like open questions, and then round out the 90 minutes with a few final words. So just know that there'll be a practice. There'll be a time for questions after the practice. Before we dive in very briefly about upcoming offerings, I'm guiding a course that starts next week called Being the Earth, which is a live call series that complements the pre-recorded course called Practical Animism. So it's actually a lot of material, and it's all about Earth 3 connection and the kind of terrain we're talking about here. It's like a bit theoretical, but lots of practices as well. So we'll have a good time with that. There's also a lot of free talks open through Ancestral Medicine. The Ancestral Lineage Healing course is open. And we also, for the first time, I'm participating in a free talk in November that's Spanish only, which I'm happy about. And yeah, that's probably it for the moment. I want to encourage folks to definitely check out the Emerald podcast that Josh guides, as along with other related offerings and study groups, teachings. It's a really well-produced, smart, nourishing, creative way to engage with this terrain. So, like, strong encouragement to check that out. It's high quality, and yeah, that's what I got for by way of intro. Let me say a thing real briefly, why a motivation for doing this topic. Partly it's that there's no right way to go about the Earth reconnection work. In a sense, it's a funny thing because we're already connected. We're inseparably already the thing. So it's like bringing conscious our inherent already connectedness. But even if we reframe it like that, there's not a right way to go about it. You know, I'm a teacher at heart, and having been immersed in teaching these things for maybe 20 years and looking at my own process of reconnection, I know that there's a strong this conditioning of perfectionism within me. It's like, what's the right way? I want to get it right. I want to do it the right way. And that's not all bad, but there are so many differently beautiful ways to re-engage. And then there are so many differently complex and demanding and playful powers with which we can engage, that it's such a like non-linear, varied landscape. And for if you've internalized the story about like, what should I be doing? What's the right way to go about it? What are the best teachings? What are the best practices? No problem, but it's good to notice how that conditioning can actually be an impediment at times to the nourishing, crashing around, non-linear finding of our way with stuff. So that's the main kind of meta context that feels important to me to set out at the start. With that, let me turn it over to Josh and enjoy whatever you might want to bring. I'm really glad you're here. So I look forward to just hearing from you. Thanks.
Yeah, Daniel, thanks. It's awesome to be here. I see some familiar faces, and really happy to be invited into this forum to talk a bit and share around what I guess is probably my favorite topic in the universe. So, so it's a joy, and thanks for having me. And really feeling what you were just saying about the right way to do it, right? We live in a time when people are wanting a deeper connection with animacy, wanting a deeper connection with the living earth. And, you know, we can study best practices and protocols, and I've spent a lot of time in my life studying those best practices and protocols in varying traditions. And I think it's important for us in the Western world particularly to feel into and remember that perhaps what she wants most is our hearts on a plate. If we were to take something from the Mesoamerican traditions, perhaps what the great goddess wants most is our hearts on a plate. In other words, you know, when we're cracked wide open and we come with that full devotional feeling of reconnection and, oh, I've been away from you for so long, great earth, and I just really want and feel how much I want and long to reconnect with you, that longing stirs a resonance, right? That longing stirs forces. And I'm reminded of a quote from the Rig Veda, which says that the gods eat praise song, right? So that the praise and longing and grief and emotional texture and mood that we feel towards the earth, like, this is what stirs things up, and this is what gets things moving. And sometimes the too much consideration of the quote unquote right way to do it can interfere with that. It can interfere with the full body multi-sensorial experience of connecting back to the earth. One of the things I felt very and continue to feel very strongly in the study in Indian tradition that I've done, when you go to India and you go to like village animist goddess shrines and this type of thing, you see that it is a multi-sensory, tactile, felt, devotional interaction. It's not an interaction of, you know, I know I want to reconnect with the earth, so I'm hiking in the woods and I'm kind of checking out how everything's beautiful. And yeah, I'd really like to reconnect with the earth. And it's not a mental process, if that makes sense. It's a process of actually starting to wake up sense faculties, a process of actually starting to feel again, a process of actually starting to wake up our skin, to wake up dead tissue, to wake up perhaps ancestral organs of perception that we never even knew were there, right? So, you know, in the case of these Indian goddess shrines, like, they're covered with offering, completely covered with offering, so much so that you can barely see the stone underneath them, right? They are slathered with, you know, depending on the shrine and who it's to, they're slathered with offerings. They're slathered with powders and pigments and dyes, right? It's felt, it's textural, there's fingerprints all over. You know, I'm contrasting that with kind of the image I've had, you know, of going into a European cathedral, and, you know, there are cathedral spaces that I like, but there's a distance there. There's, you know, you're here and whatever is divine is over there, and there is a great gulf between the two of you. And to wake up a reconnection to the animate, to me, means starting to explore really a multi-sensory, tactile, deep relationship. We wake up the sense of smell, we wake up the sense of sight, we wake up the sense of touch. And then that relationship is thorough, right? There's always care being taken. There's always dialogue happening, right? So we tend to be timid around this, I think, in the Western world, what you can kind of loosely call the Western world. We tend to be timid around this because we're just learning to wake up those, you know, relationships and faculties again. And it's kind of like, oh, I don't want to step on any toes, and I don't want, you know what I mean? And the invitation is to sing it out, to speak it out, to offer it in words, to offer it in poetry, right? The invitation is to have it be tactile. The invitation is to have it be felt. The invitation in animist tradition is always to have some type of feeding involved. This is something that, like, you know, if you want to look at common foundations in animist tradition, this is something that's deeply important, like that there's some element of feeding, right? That something's being fed, because the recognition, right, of this reciprocal relationship we're in with the planet is that we're in a food cycle. We're in a cycle in which we devour to live, and then we pass on, and the earth devours us, and it is a constant cycle of devouring, dying, rebirthing, devouring, dying, rebirthing. And so animist traditions feed the earth. They feed the entities around them. There are some traditions who would not recognize, you know, anything other than feeding. Like if it's animate, it has to involve feeding in one way or another, right? There has to be some element of feeding, or else it's, you know, what is it? It's conceptual, cerebral, it's, you know, can be beautiful. But I have not seen an animist tradition that does not feed regularly. So the relationship is meant to be thorough, right? It's meant to involve feeding. It's meant to involve the senses. It's meant to involve, like, you know, breaking down some of the, you could say, like, veils that 3,000 years of literacy and modernity and civilization have put between us and the living, breathing earth, and finding direct, deep relationality. And that deep relationality means, like, all of the levels of relationality of an actual love relationship. So this segment we're doing today is called Earth as Lover, right? And that's beautiful. And then you think of your actual relationship with your actual lover, and it's not all roses, right? The animate relationship involves grief. It involves sometimes alienation. It involves feelings of separation. It involves glorious returns. All the depth and texture of a relationship with our cherished lover, we can bring to our relationship with the earth. And if we really bring that thoroughness and regularity, you know, it's different than just kind of every once in a while saying, oh yes, I want to feel kind of reconnected, right? When we bring, like, say, a regular ritual practice into play, then that regular ritual practice will bring up for us frictions. It'll bring up for us times where, you know, okay, I'm going to do the practice today, but I don't feel connected at all. You know what I'm talking about? Like those days when it's like, this is a pain and this is boring and why am I doing this? And the earth isn't shouting to me like it should be, right? That's part of a thorough relationship. And what that thorough relationship calls us to do is to show up anyway, to show up over and over again, to show up when the relationship is difficult, to show up for all the minutiae of all the textures of communication between us and the animate. So there may be days when the world around us is really humming and we just feel kind of a seamless dialogue. And there may be days when it feels distant and far away. And there may be layers and walls of grief sometimes that we need to pass through in order to find our way to the arms of the mother. And there's also a big reconciliation, and I'm probably reaching the limit of my time. You can just let me know, Daniel. There's also a big reconciliation that I feel must be part of it in one way or another, which is that the earth, or if we want to call her the mother, we can call her by many, we can call the earth by many, many names. We can call the animate force by many, many names. The reconciliation that I'm speaking of is understanding, earth as lover, yes, as kin, yes, and also as the thing that is going to one day kill us. Right? Death, to open up a real, raw, loving, heartfelt relationship with the planet requires understanding that death is an absolutely primary and integral part of nature, that death is nature. And the great mother, in the Indian traditions, there are these incredible visions of the goddesses who are both fierce and nurturing at the same time, right? Like Mother Tara, who's popular up in Bengal and down in Odisha and these parts of India. There's a beautiful image of her, draped in heads and limbs and, draped in death, basically. And simultaneously, she's breastfeeding Shiva, who burned his throat while drinking the poison, right? She's breastfeeding Shiva, like nurturing him. And it's this image of the mother as death and all that is terrifying and all that is awe-inspiring about nature, right? And all that, makes us go, whoa, right, okay, my time in this body is finite, right? And the nourishment and the beauty, all of this in one, right? This is nature. Nature is not just the beautiful pastoral backdrop. A thorough relationship with nature means understanding nature as the devourer, right? Who, again, to quote the Mesoamerican traditions, wants our hearts on a plate, which I mean, I feel means she wants our loving presence. She wants a thorough relationship with us. And she responds when we come with longing, with devotion, with rawness of feeling, right? Like rawness of feeling. Like, oh, I'm alive, I'm in this body, I'm here, I'm, permeated by forces, surrounded by forces. I'm navigating this life, and this world nourishes me and supports me and eventually will claim me too. And I'm here for all of it. I'm here to feed you and sing to you. I'm here to honor you. And then when the time comes to be taken as dust, as bones, and reabsorbed into her great loving body, I'm here for that too. Those are a few thoughts.
Beautiful. Thank you, Josh. Why don't we take just a moment to allow that to land? Appreciate your emphasis on the path not necessarily being pleasant one way or another, that might come as a byproduct or there might be moments of it, but it's not the goal per se. It's my instinct to open by sharing a little about confusion and fear and their importance on the path. It's just kind of the mood I'm in. I'm not feeling like especially afraid or confused right now, but I want to say a thing about it. And before that, even one of the things I'm interested to chat with you about, Josh, is like animist pedagogy and like how people actually come back into relationship, what helps with that. And I know that from my own experience, one of the biggest challenges for me, for others, is believing we already know a thing. Like, I've already met you. I already know, like, the shape of you. I've already met this animal. I know what a tiger is. I've studied them. I've seen documentaries about them. I know what tigers are. And then that's different than a full encounter with a physical tiger or the spirit of the tiger goddess coming to me in a strong dream or a waking vision, etc. And so I want to apply that a bit to the earth, but it could apply to any relationship. Well, I think I know my spouse. We have two kids. We've been married for 9 years. We're friends before that. And does it help if I assume that I think I know the depth of her as a person? Probably doesn't actually help. And so we do that. And so there's a lot of unlearning or recognizing that our perception of the world is typically always incomplete and can get in the way of the immediacy of relationship. So I say that about the earth as well, because we can come with stories of like, oh, the earth is being destroyed by humans, or the earth is a nurturing mother and we're harming her. I'm not saying that's false, but I'm saying it's not the complete story of the very multidimensional ancient deity that is also us. These are also the words of the earth. This interaction is an interaction between many faces and bodies who are the earth. And we are full of secrets and full of hidden things as well. And so it's good to have that sense of openness to new encounter in this terrain. And so about confusion, like I want to talk about this because I'm putting on my psychology hat for a moment to notice that this pattern of being like, I understand you. I understand the earth. I've been doing earth spirituality stuff since I was a teenager. I got this. Or I understand my partner. I understand my kids. I understand what I'm talking about, whatever. That it's not problematic. It's like it creates a functional, stabilized ability, like to move in the world, a kind of provisional confidence. But if we fail to see that it's like just patching things together enough to function, then we'll take it for the truth, right? So it can become a kind of control stance to assume that you know another, and a stance of just enjoying that settled and clear, I got this feeling. And in one of my favorite surahs in the Quran is the surah the Zilzala, the earthquake in Arabic. But it begins, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, إذا زلزلت الأرض زلزالها وأخرجت الأرض أثقالها وقال الإنسان ما لها. It's like the earth, when the earth opens, إذا زلزلت الأرض, when the earthquake does its earthquaking thing, and begins to speak and like turns inside out, humans are going to be like, what the hell is going on? Loose translation. And the verse goes on. I'm not going to get so Quran about it in the moment, but like a lot of the teachings on the time of reckoning or the day of judgment or just the direct encounter, which is always characterized as intimate and typically intense, there's often imagery of inversion or reversal. The things that are solid become not solid. The earth, as the highly most solid, dense thing we take for granted, is moving now. We have an earthquake situation. The earth has opened up. What is secret and hidden is becoming revealed. And humans in our sense of self are like, whoa, this is very unsettling. And then the verse goes on, and like anyone who's known committed a drop of goodness will know it, and a drop of, you know, kind of maliciousness will know it. So there's a sense of getting the gift of meeting the repercussions of our actions. And the What I appreciate about the verse is the sense of like, this is going to be confusing probably when it happens. And from a mystical tradition, it's encouraged to invite this before the death of the body, because it of course has the overtones of the death of the body is a kind of earthquake. And so the soul is going to be like, whoa, did I make good choices? What's going on? Next reality, do I got this or not? And I think of it in that way because in psychology is a popular theory from John Bowlby of attachment theory. And it's cool. There's a lot of good things about it. We could critique it in a different moment. But one of the flavors of insecure attachment, which can be healed and worked with, and there's a lot of reality to this, is disorganized attachment. And it's typically when young people have experienced their caregivers as a source of real danger. And it sucks to like see kids have that experience of like, I need you, I'm afraid of you at the same time. And so kindness, it's a very real thing. And our experience of the earth is not so dissimilar to that. I need to eat. I'm completely dependent on you. And I'm dependent on the earth to provide for my girls, to provide and like for my own existence. And the earth is potentially deadly. The earth could open up. There could be a big earthquake. There could be so many things, right? And so in that way, this psychological disorganized attachment of like, I need you, I love you, you're dangerous. It's a really deep structure and a deep thing that we're asked to like hold as a full polarity, as Josh was speaking to with some of the faces of the mother. Let me say a few last things, so I don't want to take up too much time. I want to say a thing about fear, which gets a bad rap in spiritual circles. It's like, are you down with love or fear? As if that's the binary. I mean, we don't want to be afraid all the time, but fear has a really important role and is connected to awe and humility and lots of things. And, you know, I got two kids in the house, two young kids. I know Josh does as well, so we have in common. And I haven't even really started to talk with them about what we've done. The older one's almost six. Like, as soon as I start to try to talk about it, I'm like, I'm too emotional. I can't even, like, let her, just going to get it bit by bit. And it's not that I'm afraid for the earth per se. The earth will carry on. I don't actually worry that humans won't pull through. I think we will. It's just a question of how extreme will the avoidable suffering we invoke be. I mean, really bad, super extremely bad, or oh my God, surprisingly, that's worse than I thought it would even be bad. Those are kind of our options. But I have fear for what's coming and for what is already playing out. And it's not like this, it's not the big spiritual fear in the sense that, yeah, the earth will swallow, the sun will swallow the earth. This is going to sort out in the long term. But that's not the reality that we're living in. It's more like I got a mosquito bite today. I'm like, oh, is that a tiger mosquito? There's dengue here in Spain now. How would it be if I got dengue fever? That would be a thing. It's not, I'm not above it. Our girls were in the hospital, one of them last fall, with the respiratory thing. Like, it could happen. The earth could take us back. And maybe there's a wildfire. Maybe it's near our home. Maybe it's just hard to breathe. Like, so I'm not above the consequences. None of us are, of the changes we're bringing. And I bring that up because for me, to be in relationship with the earth is to want to dwell in reality and to not turn away from what's happening and to welcome the full spectrum of intensity, confusion, fear, and how being in relationship with the powers over time, they're going to invite us to hold more and more complexity. It's like, oh, you want to know me? Great. We've been enjoying a nice connection. Oh, you actually want to go deeper? It's going to be destabilizing. That's how going deeper often looks, because there's a need to shake up the comfort of where we're at. And so to do that, and so I'll say last thing, and then we'll head into conversation mode. Often the price of entry is the story of who we've been. And it can also be our comfort. And the comfort that comes from thinking we got it kind of mapped out. And that we, okay, I got this. Like, great, that's good for a while. And then we kind of start to get it, the clothes get a little tight. The spirits are like, you got this. Do you want to plateau? Or do you actually want to keep growing? Because if you want to keep growing, you don't got this like you think you do. There needs to, you kind of need to, it'll cost you your story that you got it. And that's going to just be less comfortable for a little while. So it's, I'm not saying it's always like that, but I say that because there's a, for folks who are newer to like, oh, I want to get involved in earth spirituality stuff. Great. I recommend it. And it is a journey of many lifetimes that is very strange and is absolutely about studying our own nature because we're the earth, and is about holding as much contradiction as we can possibly tolerate without fracturing. So, yeah. So some of that. Let's shift into a dialogue kind of space. I want to, because I've been talking for a bit, I want to pause to see if there's anything right off, Josh, on your heart. Otherwise, you know, there are different questions I think it'd be fun to get into or ask of you, but let me pause first.
Yeah, I mean, the topics you brought up are things that we could spiral around for years. So, you know, there's, I mean, so many moments that stand out for me. There's a story in the Indian tantric traditions, and a point in the story where the Divine Mother has undertaken this terrible meditation and drawn the entire universe into her body and kind of compressed into this single point. And Shiva is really impressed, and so he comes and bows down before her and worships her, and the goddess bursts out of this single point, out of this single stone. There's this moment where she bursts out of, and she's in a new form. And this is the form of nature, basically. She's in this fierce and nurturing, and it's described, you know, as horrifying, terrifying, and it's also described as beautiful beyond compare, right? Nature is terrifying when you really understand, like, all right, nature's gonna take me out too. Like a friend of mine is fond of saying, last time I checked, the death rate is 100%. The mortality rate is 100%, right? Like, nature is terrifying. You know, the vastness, even to really grok, to comprehend the vastness of a universe with, at last count, 2 trillion galaxies, 100 billion stars each. Like, it's, the vastness itself is awe-inspiring. And like you're saying, this kind of artificial dichotomy between love and fear in kind of modern spiritual systems. You know, there's a name for the divine in the Indian traditions, Bhairava, which really implies this kind of awesome fear, bliss, you know, the understanding that the nature of the universe is, you know, spontaneous play, and the nature of that spontaneous play is infinite, and in its infinite manifestation and the infinite forms through which it manifests, it is awe-inspiring, bliss-inspiring, fear-inspiring, and these things are intermingled. And so if you think of, I think, Danny, you and I were kind of chatting about this the other day, but if you think of our ancient ancestors, our Paleolithic ancestors, If you think of those just absolutely beautifully meticulous paintings on the cave walls, I think Daniel's pretty near where some of these are. There are paintings of animal beings in those caves that are more anatomically correct than modern painters. They've done studies of the, anatomical correctness of the Paleolithic art from 35,000 years ago and found that modern painters are just getting their way back to where, that is a thorough relationship, right? A thorough relationship with the animal herd, a thorough relationship with the animal being. And if you really feel into like the nature of what that relationship was, that relationship, love, right? Awe. There was an adoration of the animal because the animal is what? The animal is food. The animal is life. The animal is like complete dependence upon the animal, right? Like you're talking about, Daniel. Like the animal is the source of the nourishing blood that spills forth from it is what is going to ensure generational continuity. It's what's going to ensure that I can feed my kids. The animal is this. And then the hunt of the animal is beautiful and it's precarious and it's dangerous and it's horrifying and it's intimate. And it's all of these things at once. The animal is the thing, like the size of these Paleolithic animals, the animal herd. If you imagine them thundering through the canyon, the gorge, and those hunts that transpired, the animal is the source of life, and the animal is the thing that could take you out of this life in an instant, right? And this experience of earth, of animal, of nature as provider and demolisher, just like any transformation we undergo involves fear and awe and wonder and bliss. That experience is ultimately rapturous. Rapture, the experience of ecstasy, the experience of rapture, which is how so many traditions, even though those traditions that live closest to the earth and our ancestral traditions, they experience these forces of nature in states of rapture. Ceremony ritual exists to take us into states of rapture through which to better perceive animate energies, right? Like in the Kalahari, they live like in nature and they still need to spend a whole lot of their time dancing themselves into states of rapture in order to feel the forces of nature and communicate with them more thoroughly, right? So it's not just like, oh, if you land in nature, you're fine and that's all you've got to do, right? It's like there's a demand for some type of alteration of consciousness, and the place that that alteration of consciousness takes us to, the place that it takes the Dionysian dancer or the Indian trance medium, or the examples are limitless. The place that it takes us to is awe, bliss, fear, wonder, the experience of being blown out of the individual self and taken into this great into the arms of this great devouring universe. It's like being reconstructed and devoured at the same time. You feel what I'm talking about? I'm sure many of you have had tastes of this experience, right? And so the invitation is not like to like just an experience of like the joy of creation. And it's not an invitation like when we say fear into like a kind of like modern fear has manifested as this like just perpetual gnawing anxiety, which is something very, very different, right? It's about awe. And in that place of awe, right, we can behold nature as it actually is without so many filters of preconception. And in that beholding of nature as it actually is, we can gain insights then to translate into our communities and our lives and our bodies. And that's been the journey for a very long time. But that journey, historically and traditionally, only happens if there's some type of death experience, if there's some type of fear, if there's some type of, breaking through. And that breaking through is essential to having an actual, real, relationship with the earth. Having an actual real relationship with the forces around us. Just like the experience of, being in a love relationship, Yeah, I've seen love relationships that were very detached and removed and at a distance, but the invitation, right, is to show up on a much different level. The invitation is to show up in a much deeper way. And to do that requires some type of demolishment of the self, and it requires traversing spaces where fear and wonder and bliss and pain and grief and joy melt seamlessly into one.
Thanks for that. It's partly what I was hoping to underscore earlier, as well as it were less about chasing a certain state or a certain even feeling of connectedness, so much as increasing range for lots of different kinds of experiences without needing to diminish them. One of the things that I wanted to make sure to ask while we're together here. I almost went to law school, for environmental law to try to contribute to the systems being better and more ecologically oriented. I remember one time years ago in university walking really directly from one class to another to burn fewer calories, to need to eat less food, to have less ecological impact. And I'm like, oh, this is going in a bad direction, Daniel. Where are you going here? Because it was it, the logical conclusion at that point is like, why don't you kill yourself in service to the earth, which I don't advocate as a strategy. And but what I came to, in part, it partly why I didn't pursue law school, although respect to people doing good advocacy law, is that there aren't really environmental problems. That's a weird construct. There's human behavior problems, or there's like maladaptive, selfish human behaviors. We can call them problems. I think they're problematic if we want a loving, ecologically well world. And those problems, those problematic behaviors, arise from a misunderstanding of who we are, our responsibilities in the larger web of kinship, our inherent connectedness and indebtedness and dependencies and from a human supremacy or arrogance, whether or not we're like, I'll check that, I'll take the human supremacy. Most people don't sign up for it consciously. It's just cooked into the systems. And so then my preoccupation with my adult life has been, how do I leverage whatever capacities I have to try to shift that and participate in affirming the opposite of human supremacy, which for me, animism is an intellectual shorthand way to point to that terrain. But the living of it is a whole complex, diverse, messy bunch of things. And so, I trained as a therapist. That seemed to help a little bit. So I'm like a little bit, at the very least, less in my way than I would have been had I not done a bunch of therapy ongoing. Also, it helps me to see how much human suffering impacts our ability to learn and is just so defining to life in many ways. And how much people hold, how much pain a lot of people are walking with. But in that, this question of like, what helps people to come back into relationship? The ancestral focus. That's great, but it's for me, it's always been a kind of subcategory of this larger earth reconnection or earth remembering process. So my question for you, I have the impression you've done years and years of practice and been doing this great teaching and transmitting with the podcast. And I think it's a somewhat newer thing to be like guiding bigger groups in person so I'm curious what you're learning. Like, what's one or two things where you're like, oh, this is actually helping the process of coming back into relationship? I wasn't sure if it would help, but it definitely is. Or this is one or two things I've tried that I thought would help, but it isn't actually what is getting us there. What are you noticing about what helps people to get out of the I already got this bubble, or to actually come into communion, or You get what I mean. Yeah. What do you learn?
Yeah. I mean, your preamble had so many juicy bits in there that I could comment on. Like, and then the question is kind of a separate thing. I'm like having to restrain myself from going down a Anthropocene detour there, but maybe I'll find a way to weave it in. I'm glad you stuck around. And
Me too.
yeah. I guess I can weave these together because, both I'm gonna take a moment to weave from the beginning of what you were saying and then come to the direct question. So like both the notion that human beings are at the pinnacle of creation and the notion that we're a blight to be removed, both are incredibly self-centered viewpoints, right? Robin Wall Kimmerer talks about this very eloquently, but she talks again about the vision that many, many indigenous traditions and many cultures, nature-based cultures have had of the human role is again one of thoroughness. It's one of depth and thoroughness of relationality with the earth. Like we're not here to just kind of, oh, we're not part of nature, we're just going to let nature be nature. Right, that again comes from a split sensibility in which we're somehow removed from nature, right? So like understanding that human beings have historically had an incredibly thorough role to play in and this is something I'm just going to put out there for maybe people who've traveled to different sacred geographies and places where there's a really vigorous relationship between humans and land. Like here where I live, the Tewa people, the Pueblo people, there's been obviously a history of colonization here, but at the same time, they're also on their ancestral lands. And they continue to practice ceremony on their ancestral lands, and they continue to name the animate forces and sing out loud to them and offer to them and feed to them, and dance with their feet pounding on the earth in a heartbeat that calls the thunderheads in the summertime, right? That feeling is in the land here. And I'd be interested to just kind of see from people, like, have you ever felt the difference between land that is thoroughly engaged with and related to versus land that's just kind of been left alone, right? There's a difference. And that difference doesn't always manifest. Like we think of pristine wilderness, right? We think of like, oh, if it's pristine wilderness, if humans are letting it be entirely, then that's like the natural state. Well, a lot of cultures will tell you that actually land reaches its maximum humming, vibrant, rich, radiant potentiality when it's being sung to and offered to and interacted with by human beings. That there is an absolute reciprocal role to play there. So I've been in land that has been let go dormant for many, many years. Maybe you've walked through land that's felt dormant, right? Has anybody walked through land that's felt kind of dormant, like the energies there were sleeping? And I've been to land that was absolutely humming with vibrancy, and the songs of the people were being echoed back by the land, and there was just something very, very tangible going on. So again, there's this idea, or not idea, this practice of thoroughness, right? That human beings do have a role to play. And a big part of the role that we have to play is in having a thorough relationship. And that thorough relationship means offering, feeding, singing back. So one of the things that I've found, gonna bring it into your question a little bit more now. One of the things that I've found that's been, really helping, I mean, really the entirety of the coursework that I'm doing is based around helping people reestablish that humming, vibrant connection using as foundation the way that traditional cultures from around the world have approached this so that people can take these foundations into their own traditions, right? It's not about teaching a particular tradition. It's about looking at what has worked for people around the world for a very long time that may be able to be translated into people's own ritual practice. And what I find is that, Literacy is a wonderful thing. Books are a wonderful thing. There's many of them right over here, right? Books are wonderful. But there's also a veil that literacy places between us and the world. And a lot of the work that I'm hoping to help do is to break down a little bit of that veil so that in many traditions, right, to start humming along to the sound of the waters, to start invoking place names, to start asking for permission to enter natural spaces. Right, to start actually developing a verbal dialogue with land, it's important that it's verbal. It's important that it's out loud. It's important that it's not just in the head. This is because we live in a world of vibration and animate forces are vibrational, and people sing, cultures sing to the world everywhere to hum along with the song of creation. Right, and this is something very simple and it's very tangible, but it's very easy to forget. In a literate world where we can think, you know, oh, I'm reconnecting simply by thinking about reconnecting. I'm reconnecting simply by seeing, right? Seeing is wonderful. I love the sense of sight. I love the shapes that you can start to see, right? But really, when we start invoking out loud, things start to change. There starts to be a shift. We start to feel the world humming along with us. I also really am working with getting people in the practice of feeding regularly feeding, like having a practice of offering flame, of offering water, of offering milk, of offering flowers, of offering scents, of offering food. That one can be a barrier for people, but it's something that animate traditions all around the world do. They offer food. And if it's something our mind goes, well, what would be the value? Like, you know, what would be the actual value, you know, of offering food? And are they really, who's going to eat it and all this kind of stuff? And my suggestion is try it for 6 months. Try it every day for 6 months. Tend a little shrine in your backyard to the natural forces and feed it. Feed it food. Yeah. Things like this, like, you know, the simplicity of practice, I've found, you know, the direct invitation to feel this in our bodies and do it every day over and over and over again, instead of letting it be a theoretical exercise. This is really important for us in the modern West. Everyone probably on this call knows the reasons why intellectually we should deepen our relationship with the earth, right? The question then becomes, can I somatically put it into practice every single day so that a hum starts to build? A friction starts to build, a thoroughness starts to develop. So that's what I've been working with. Like, that's what I feel is kind of resonating and working. I don't know. There's some folks on the call here who've been taking a course with me for the past year, so they can tell you whether it's working or not. But you know, that's really what I'm, you know, hoping to kindle. Right, there's a friction, a fire that needs to be kindled. There's a hum, a latent hum that needs to be reawoken. Right, there's a hum that exists between us and land around us, and we're so shy and timid, and there's like colonial guilt living in many of us of like, I'm not allowed to do this, and it's not my land, and where did I come from? And like you said at the very beginning, sometimes the shoulds can get us away from the raw reality of the fact that those animate forces want to be honored. They want to hear our songs. They want to sing with us, along with us. You know, if want to isn't a word you would choose, we can say nature responds. Nature responds when dialogued with, when interacted with. And I'm sure everybody has felt that in one way or another, right? I mean, try simply humming for a little while out in nature and see what happens. You know, it sounds like so simple, but there's a reason that there are, you know, dozens and dozens of tantric practices around humming, simply around humming, right? There's a reason for it. Oh, we start to vibrate the internal apparatus of the human being, the somatic apparatus, and then all of a sudden things wake up, and then all of a sudden we hear things a little more acutely, and then all of a sudden we find the resonance in certain spaces, and then that resonance creates a singing back. And so I guess like the number one thing I would say that I'm exploring and hoping to help others explore is the tactile tangibility of rekindling the relationship with the animate, not the theoretical, but the tangible. Yeah.
Yeah, beautiful. I feel no resonance with that, or similar. in a sense. I appreciate that you happen to also have the bonus faculty of being an intellectual scholar type person, because I think in my experience at least, it can put folks who have that faculty really developed at ease a bit and cause them to feel a little safer trusting you to come along with. So thanks Josh. Why don't we, in that spirit, make sure that we are in the doing and not only the talking about, and spend 10, not more than 15 minutes in direct practice. And the invitation here, Josh and I co-weave a bit, and the invitation is just to gift yourself with a little bit of time with the intent of being body intuitively aware, and perhaps to turn attention to the land, to the earth, wherever you might be, assuming you're not on a boat, but most people aren't on the call. But even so, you'll figure it out if so. Sorry, it's kind of random. I've had people calling on houseboats. I'll talk you through it. Or we'll talk you through it. Go ahead and bring your attention, if you would, to your body, your breath, your heart, your belly, your feet. Do what helps you to be settled in your body. And while that's happening, notice at least one point of connection with the sacred, the greater, your guides, your teachers, the earth, God, the gods, love. But notice the greater in this moment and how you're connected up in that way. From this place of being rooted in your body and connected, hold intent that your personal space is cleansed or clear from negativity, interference, anything that doesn't need to be right up around your personal space in this moment. And finally, let there be a gentle layer of protection around your space, that only what is safe and welcome is allowed to be around you at this time. And from that place, being rooted in your body, connected, clear and protected, take just a moment and listen in an open-ended way to see if there's anything from what's been spoken so far, from your intuition, your guidance, that's really important and really present. Just allow for a moment of spaciousness before we do a thing.
So, in this spacious moment, in this time of spaciousness, a simple invitation to feel into the ways in which you normally connect with the natural world around. So, when you're on a hike or out in the woods, what sense faculties are at play? Is it a mostly visual experience? Is it an experience through the soles of the feet, the feeling of the air as you walk down a path on the skin? Is there a listening element involved? How could this experience deepen? How could we start to wake up different, perhaps more somatic, more ancestral ways of listening? One thing to explore is listening that happens not just through the ears, but listening that happens through the entire somatic system. So listen now. Listen, yes, through the ears. Listen also through the scalp, the skin of the scalp. Listen through the pores. Listen through the hair follicles. How does it feel to listen through the hair follicles? Hair, the ancestral fur, is a sense organ. The furred and whiskered beings listen through the hair. And then this body covered in hair follicles, covered in pores, we can start to wake up a deeper way of listening. Listening through the skin. Listen through the skin of the back. Listen through the skin of the soles of the feet. Listen even into the marrow of the bones, as if the marrow and the bones was a liquid organ of listening. Listen, feeling what it is to listen through the whole body at once. And even the air around the body can become part of this field of listening. Can feel what it is to listen through the air 3 inches away from the body. To listen through the air around the scalp, around the soles of the feet. To listen through the air around the back, around the pelvic floor. Attuning us to a deeper capacity of listening. One thing we can do when we want to hear more deeply is increase the surface area of listening towards the object we want to listen to, the being we want to listen to. So if we're listening to a creek, the sound of the rushing water, one thing we can do is turn the palms, and people can try this now. You can take your palms kind of up by your ears on either side of your face, a few inches away. And palms facing front, And feel that you're able to listen through the palms, listen through the fingertips. So in many spiritual traditions, this is a gesture that you'll see, right? And the skin of the palms is sensitive, and it can pick up on things, slight changes in the movement of the breeze, rustling in the forest. And we can start to simply approach the natural world from a deep somatic place, understanding that the posture that we place ourselves in relation to the earth around us matters. So maybe we're not just the vertical human walking through nature as a detached observer, that we're participating, that we're opening up our hands, our fingers to feel and listen. Yeah, sticking out the tongue allows us to feel changes in the air around us. Yeah, cupping the hands around the ears is a very simple, old, tried and true hunter's technique. We see like the deer with their big ears. And if we simply increase the surface area of the ears, it changes our ability to listen to the voice of the wilderness around us. There are many ways that we can start to work to wake up sense faculties that perhaps have been a little bit dormant. And I think the heart of it is to start to have the intent so that when we take a step into the wood, into the forest, it's not just with the intention of, oh, I'm gonna hike from point A to point B and everything I see along the way is fine, right? It's, I step into the wood and this wood is alive with forces and I'm here to listen. I'm here to listen more deeply. Take a breath in and a breath out. You can shake the limbs a little bit. Maybe rub the palms together. And then take the palms to the eyes and give the eyes a little rub, waking up the sense faculties here. And you can tap the scalp. And give the hands one more shake. And then open the eyes if the eyes have been closed. So traditions like the Qigong tradition are really good at waking up these deep sense faculties. And there's a lot to learn from indigenous hunting and tracking traditions about waking up sense faculties. And these are simply some very simple ways to explore next time you're in the wood, in the wild. Explore walking through as an organ of listening.
Staying with the openness invited, perhaps with your hands open, take a moment, if you're drawn to do so, to notice the land, the earth beneath you. There's not a need to reach for a thing. It's just the shift in attention for just a moment of acknowledgement not needing to make a big thing happen, but take a moment and just listen from your place of center in an embodied way to how in this very moment the land where you're at would rise up to meet you. I mean, there's not a need to do a thing, to change anything. If anything is sort of more than you would wish, it's okay to decline the intensity. But just to be with, knowing also at some level that you two are the earth. And in the specific contours of your moment of just sharing presence with the land where you're at, see if there's enough extra space to acknowledge in any way that there are millions and millions and millions, billions, as it were, of other just humans having a different experience of the earth, more or less consciously. And there's space for all of that difference and complexity while you honor the very specific flavor and contours of your moment. We'll transition in just a moment out of the space of direct practice, but, and sure, from this place, it's possible to make prayer, to make intent, to direct our awareness in 100 different beneficial ways. But in this moment, I'd like to just underscore that sharing presence is the foundation for those options. And so in this moment of acknowledging the cycles and the balance of light and dark on this good earth, we take just another moment together and just share presence. With that, and at your own rhythm, you know, staying in easeful connection if you wish. Perhaps acknowledge a shift out of the space of direct practice and into, you know, more dialogue or teaching. Thanks for all that's been shared. Thanks, Josh, for your weaving. And I do want to make a little space for a few folks to be able to share. If you would say a word, you can raise your hand in the, you know, the world of Zoom. But if we call on you, share words succinctly where you're calling in from. And if you would, kind of go to the heart of it with the share. If you have a question or something you want to bring, just to make space for others. Yeah, let's open it up a little. It's important. To make at least some space for that. Catherine and Laura.
Hi, just wanted to thank you so much for creating this space and this opportunity to just reflect on these concepts and just I'll dive right in. I live in a part of San Diego that is mostly a public space. I live on a boat, and the peninsula we live on is I really resonated with that idea that land that is somewhat neglected seems to sort of almost feel empty. I took some friends and we started picking up the litter on the land today and beautifying it. And it sort of broke that feeling of almost like it was cursed. Just and all it took was just coming into relationship with her and putting some energy into the space. It sort of broke that kind of anxiety that I sometimes felt coming into those places where there's maybe more transience or just more mental health issues. And I think that's just a simple shift that we made, and I want to continue to make and just sort of steward this little space that so many people pass through but don't really engage. So thank you.
For sure. Thanks, Catherine. I'll open it if Josh wants to say anything. And just briefly, I'm struck by, for one, this is a confusion in psychology. You know, I can pick on it because I trained as a therapist, I have a PhD in psychology, but there's this idea sometimes that we should, like, this self-responsibility means that everything is internal and that we should be able to just control our like state, when in fact we are often very impacted by what's around us. And sometimes the way of like shifting our state, if that's a desired thing to do, is to engage, to be helpful, to like engage the larger relational field around us and do it in a tangible way. Sometimes you're making offerings, sometimes your offering is the removal of interference. My offering is an offering of subtraction. And so that doing something tangible is, that's awesome. And there's no need to seek out the dramatic mountaintop sacred grove places per se, that going to places where there's been just neglect and density can be a sweet opportunity to participate in the larger making sacred, as Josh was speaking to. So yeah, thanks, Catherine, for that, and appreciate you. Is there anything, Josh, you wanted to add? I mean, yeah, it's welcome. Yeah.
Yeah, a couple things spring to mind. That's awesome work, and often, like you're saying, we can feel a difference immediately. We can feel a difference right away. I just wanted to, you mentioned the word cursed, and just wanted to throw this into the mix, perhaps to freak out the people who are new to like animist concepts a little bit. Like, there is land that has been deliberately silenced. There is land that has been cursed, right? There's land in Europe, like very clearly, where vibrant pagan energies were squashed and suppressed deliberately. This is something that happens. So I just wanted to pick up on that and say it's not too far-fetched to words, use the word cursed. Sometimes it's neglect, like Daniel's talking about, and sometimes it's actually deliberate. And just wanted to throw that out there. And also to say, I guess an encouragement. The cleanup is awesome, and that's like, that kind of clears a space. And then the animate forces, again, they really like it when there's feeding and humming and something to get the vibration moving, right? To get it moving too. So Awesome. I wish you very well in that beautiful animate endeavor.
Laura?
Yeah, thank you. So, yeah, I'm calling from Vienna, Austria, and this actually ties into the share before, and it's like, it's a really huge question, but just in terms of like, tuning into the land and the earth, and like where I am, there's no denying of the, hundreds or like even thousands of years of really intense human impact that to a large degree was, like not that beneficial to all the others there. And just to yeah, and also, yeah, the impact that has had on different kinds of, nature spirits and forces, like like rivers coming down from the Viennese forest that are underground and now part of the what's the system, the, like the, yeah, whatever, the sewage system and all those things. And I'm, like I do see very much how, like, even, the trees in the park and whatever, like the beings here, or the, yeah, and the people here, they're very like, I mean, they're very appreciative of, when there is acknowledgement, but there is, yeah, and this applies to so many other things. And also what Josh said about sometimes there was like, intentional suppression or whatever, but often it's just like, like forgetting and ignorance or whatever, that there isn't a good relationship anymore. And how do you, yeah, I don't know, not from a, like a arrogant healer place, but how to even begin to like repair like things that are just so like huge in size and in scale. So I'll stop there.
I'm going to sum that up in a tidy way, Josh.
One of the things which you already flagged that is very encouraging is the degree to which, despite years and years and years of neglect or suppression, the degree to which animate land responds and the forces of nature respond when acknowledged. So that's just one thing to remember and to highlight. It's amazing, really. It amazes me. Like when I take a moment, if I go to a new place, if I just take a moment to connect to that place and to honor it and to maybe verbalize something, it's amazing how quickly things start to shift. And so, what I would say is very simply and slowly and through the little things, through honoring the little things, like you said, there can be, I am going to re-enchant huge swaths of land, right? Like, it's not so much that. It's like, William Blake's invitation, right, to see infinity in a grain of sand, right? There's every fractal piece is a portal to the whole. And so any little thing that we pause to take our attention to and honor is going to open up a doorway to something much vaster. So, and this is something I just feel for me and for our world these days, the constant remembrance of slowly, simply, carefully, thoroughly, right? Slowly, simply, carefully, thoroughly. And then the poetry starts to move. And there's lots of ways of honoring, right? There's the ways we've been talking about today. There's lots of ways of honoring, and to me, it starts with just the recognition, the pausing to recognize slowly and simply and steadily and repetitively. That's another thing too. The practice could be the simplest thing, like I'm going to, honor that particular stone, but then do it every day if you can. Do it every day and make a practice of it and see what starts to unfold there and in you. It's like that relationality that starts to hum with friction over time. So I guess that would be what I'd have to say on that. And also, I'm not, you know, I hope people feel this. I'm not in the business of prescribing things. So I think, like, you know, there's an invitation to try what works for you and feel it out. Thank you. And yeah, I'm happy to go 5 minutes over, Daniel. It's no
great. What I would add, you know, having been there and done some ritual together in Vienna, one thing is, as you know, anyways, not like you don't know this, but start with the waters, or make sure that, like, the river, like, where is the water coming from? I moved to Granada last year. I'm like, okay, the Genil, the Monachil, the Dilar, the Rio Durcal, who are the rivers? I mean, I know the names that have been given, whatever their histories are, and to actually greet them and to go to the source of the river before the reservoir, after the reservoir, actually gather the water, greet the waters, talk to the waters. So everyone's going to follow their instinct, but if I said four things to, like, how do you arrive in a place if you have a minute? With your ancestors at your back, greet the ancestors of the land. Be like, hey, humans who are here, I'm not bypassing you. Respect. It's like we visited a cemetery and we're just like, hey, generally the ancestors here, we're here, hi. Greet the waters, because there are places where there's humans, there's going to be some presence of water wherever the waters are coming from. Greet the plants and the green-blooded kin. I think they're typically very generous and receptive. And finally, notice who's already doing the tending there. Don't reinvent the wheel. Be like, human or otherwise, what's already going on here? Because those forces, those humans, whoever they might be, include the living humans. There's probably at least some living humans. See if you can reinforce their efforts and not come in and be like, all right, I got to figure all this out. Like, you know that, but, like, and that can require sometimes being a little bit more visible to be like, hey, I'm doing something. Anybody else doing something? Or, like, so that's the advantage of how do people find each other? Yeah. Or that's the challenge of figuring out how to find each other. But yeah, teamwork, waters, plants, and the ancestors. That's where I'll tend to start. Thanks, Flora. Yeah. Kip, and then we'll move toward completion. But I know there's other folks have questions, and sorry, we just don't have the time to get to a base question. But Kip, if you want to share a thing, and then we'll make a space for some final words from Josh and I, and then weave out.
Awesome. Thanks, Daniel. Hey, everybody. I am calling in from North Carolina, where I'm at a green woodworking festival, and I am finding working with wood to be just an awesome way to get to know trees better. And so I was wondering if Daniel and Josh, you guys could share a few words about craft and, like, making things with stuff from the earth and the role of that in all of this.
You want me to go first, Daniel? I was just out in North Carolina for a bit, and it's beautiful land there. And I recently did an episode of the podcast that was called Inanimate Objects Aren't Inanimate or Objects, which is about our relationship with things in the living world. And craft, you know, there are great mythologies and stories of you know, craft as mythic work and divine craftsmen and Tavastar the shaper in the Indian traditions and the Vedic traditions and Norse shapers and Greek shapers, Hephaestus the Greek shaper, and Like everything else in a unsundered world, craft becomes artistry, right? Artistry is an expression of an artistic universe. The universe is an artist perpetually unfolding its great craft. And so the time and focus and relationality and work with being that arises through craft is a way of reconnection to the animate. And the materials with which we are working when we do craft are animate themselves. And in many traditions, there's a whole protocol of respect that one uses around tools, tools which are all members of a family, and they're treated as members of a family. If we were to see in doing our craft that our craft is not us simply working with dead objects, but and is not even just us working with the body of the trees, but we're working with the tools that work with the bodies of the trees. And these tools are persons too, and they have the way that they like to be treated and like to be interacted with. It's a different shift in perspective on craft for us. Many traditions will tell you that paint is alive, for example, that paint is a being, right? And many other traditions will tell you that the moment the work of art is quote unquote completed, that a being comes into being. It provides a doorway for a being to come through. So starting to feel into that every aspect of what we're doing is alive, that every aspect of what we're doing involves relationality, and that we can go more deeply and more thoroughly into that relationality, I think is one of the things that what you could call, I guess, conscious craft calls us to do. There's really incredible things to be learned from how the West African traditions treat drums. I know that Daniel could probably talk more about that than I can. But starting to understand that there are natural forces that work through craft. In that episode, I interviewed a Native American sculptor who's a friend of mine named Rose B. Simpson, and she talked about like the moment that she puts the eyes in the big sculpture and how the whole being wakes up at that moment. Craft becomes a portal for beings who may not have had bodies to gain a body for a while, if that makes sense. Yeah. So it's just some things to feel into in relation to craft.
Yeah, thanks, Josh. What I'm called to say about that before we move toward kind of final, anything final is I had the good fortune. We moved last September to the Granada in Andalusia, in the south of Spain, from the US, our family. But I got to spend a week in Cantabria and Santander in the north of Spain this August, which is great because it's very hot here in the summer in the south. And there's a lot of really rich archaeology there. So I went to the Museo de Prehistoria de Cantabria and Santander. So just was hanging out with them in the museum. And in a room with all these artifacts, I think they're from the Magdalenian period, which is 12 to 17,000 years ago, maybe, which was an interesting time because the ice had covered much of northern and even central Europe, but it didn't reach to the Iberian Peninsula. It was colder here. It was continuous inhabitation for many tens of thousands of years, and even before that, with other homogeneous folks, much like us. And I won't be able to capture the moment that well. I'm still processing, but there's a moment where a real like contact from these very old ancestors, being in the presence of what they had crafted with their hands, and the image, because sometimes it's visual for me, is just like of the like working with stone on stone. I could say banging rocks, but that makes it sound like less intentional and magical, but depending on how you hear it. But working the stones, but part of what was really clear to me is that it's a collapsing of time, that it's in the same moment. It's not a moment in the past. So working with our hands is work with time. we're typically being slowed down by the things that we're working with. And there's one of my most favorite humans, he passed some 800 years ago, is Muhyiddin Ibn al-Arabi, some Muslim mystic. And but in one of his visions, he's circling the Kaaba in Mecca. I mean, he was actually physically there, but in communing with this youth who is ancient and new and male and female and like speechless and full of words and this, you know, this mystical stuff, right? And he asks the youth, "How old are you?" And the answer comes of 40,000 years. And Ibn al-Arabi is like, whoa. But in Quran or in the teachings, this Adam was like 6,000 years ago. Has like, the math doesn't work out, bro. You can't be that old because that's older than Adam. And like, what gives? And the response is like, which Adam? There have been thousands of Adams before the Adam you speak of. And it's just like mind blown. And the there's a lot of acceleration and pressure in the historical moment we're living. That's warranted. There's a lot at stake. There's a lot that's culminating quickly in geological time. And there's a lot of wisdom from the folks who are working the stones 15, 30, 45,000 years ago with the blended family, with Neanderthals or Denisovians, whoever it might be. And we're not, the details are new, but we're also participating in a very old story that is sitting in the same place in time it's always been sitting. So yeah, that's what I want to say about that. And that's great about the trees and the wood. Carry on, Kip. And the in terms of anything final from my side, I know we're a bit over time, but what? I'm glad, Josh, to connect with you. I appreciate what you're doing. And I'm wanting from my own side, I appreciate what we're doing in this moment, and I want to see more of it, frankly. I have been in the weird-ass business of being a spiritual teacher for some years now, and it is, as soon as it starts to feel like isolating or competitive or like, or I get into that weird mindset, or it's like, I don't even know how to describe it, but I want to see more cooperation and teamwork and lifting each other up and like collegial like appreciation, because there's not enough of what is happening here in the world. There's no scarcity. What we're talking about is some normal ass stuff. It should be mainstream, and I really want to see it like that. I think it's just relational ethics. It needs to be informing our institutions, our laws, our economics, our educational system, our etc. You get the thing. So I don't see what we're doing or talking about here is esoteric or even spiritual or whatever. It's just like life skills. So let us work together with one another to spread the basic values of relationality and honoring the many beings in whatever ways are fun and effective and nourishing. So thank you, Josh, for doing that in really beautiful ways. Again, encouragement to check out the Emerald podcast if you haven't, because it's lovely. And it's a nice way to plug in. And thank you all for being here. That's what I got for this evening. I'll let you have the final word, Josh.
Well, thanks so much for inviting me, and definitely echoing and reverberating the sentiment of relationality and more communal work, and really been happy to see in the past year or so that there's been a lot of communal resonance around the work that I've been doing, and wanting to dialogue and interact with more people who are feeling the longing and the urgent call. And so thanks for inviting me. I appreciate it. And apologies to the folks whose questions we're not going to get to today. And I know that there will be more opportunities to talk and dialogue. And you know, I feel that it's a great longing that drives all of us to want to be in these spaces and dive into work like this, and that the longing itself is holy. And when we long for a connection to the earth, the cosmos, the sky of stars above, when we long for this, that longing itself is the animate force moving through us. And so I'll just close in honor of this force, whatever name we call it by, the animacy, the life breath of the universe, the life breath of the world. And there's something I say when I close gatherings like this, and I'll say it here as we close. It's an honoring of the animate power in Sanskrit, Adima Shakti Ki Jai. And it means victory to the primordial mother power.